Okay. Beginning after the Mishnah, 25A1. Next page. The Afilu Chacham Nigmara says, does this apply even when a Chacham, a sage, dies? We just read, the Mishnah says, that the only people for whom you do what we have just said are Krovav Shalamet.
Right, but we had that other exception.
Here the Gemara comes and says, Ve'afilu Chacham, Va'atanya Chacham Shemet HaKol Krovav. Right? There is a Baraita that says when a sage dies, everybody is his relative. Everybody is his relative. Right, so here it just said Krovav Shalmet, the relatives of the deceased. So there's a Baraita which actually extends that to the sage, because everybody is the sage's relative. Okay? So the Gemara now discusses this issue. HaKol Krovav Salta Datach. Do you really mean that everybody is the sage's relative?
And that means close relative.
Close relative. Ella HaKol Kikarovav. That everybody is like his relative. Okay? Everybody is like his relative. Then the Baraita goes on. HaKol Korim Alav. Everybody rends their garments for him. VaKol Chotzim Alav. Everybody uncovers the shoulder for him. VaKol Mavrin Alav Berochva. That's the place. And everybody is fed the mourner's meal in the street. Berochva. That's the way they translate it here. Okay.
It's interesting that in the cemeteries in Israel, before every avenue that goes into Yisrael, you have the Rachava, and they call it Rachava.
Oh, they call it Rachava.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So maybe that's where they serve the meal. Did you go back to your house to eat, or did you eat in the cemetery?
We ate in the house.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting what you're saying.
They have a Rachava, and they call it Rachava.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, because it's a very interesting observation, because I've always been puzzled by one American custom that we have that I can never figure out. And this may be the source of it. I'll explain to you the custom. One of the odd things that we do in the American Jewish community, actually two odd things. First thing is something that you may not consider odd, but it really is odd. That is, we have an unveiling. Right? We have an unveiling. What? Only American Jews do that. No Jews do unveilings. So it's an American custom that we have. So that's odd thing number one. But it's widespread, it's done in America, and it's not considered to be odd. Number two, which is really odd, I found years ago, when I started out as a rabbi, that people always brought food to the cemetery at unveilings.
Yes.
Always. Now, some of you are nodding your head saying, of course. Other you.
No,
to eat.
That was a joke, like, you know, a tomb from Egypt to leave.
No, this is to eat.
There was a Pachis party. I mean, I went with my mother. I mean, it was Pachis.
To the cemetery.
It's on the cemetery.
People would actually, it was like going to a football game where you put down the tailgate on the car.
Absolutely.
And the people, they eat.
Hold it. This is a year after.
Whenever the unveiling is, whenever it is. So I saw this when I was a young rabbi. I saw this happen. I asked somebody, I said, well, what's the source of this? I said, oh, God knows what the source of this is. It was assumed then that the source was the following, and it was not a bad idea, that it goes back to a time in American life when, number one, it's true, at an unveiling, you have people coming from a lot of different places, right? So there's a logic to this. People coming from a lot of different places. And afterwards, they also scatter. They're going back to a lot of different places. So, there was a time in American life when you didn't have eateries all over the place. And when you would go to Queens, It was a long trip. It was a long trip to go to Queens. Didn't have the network of highways that Robert Moses or somebody else built through all those cemeteries. So that the end result was that in the old days, people would take food out to the cemetery, and it was perfectly logical that it made sense to serve it there. So I always accepted the sociological explanation. Ron, you raise another possibility now. You raise the possibility that maybe this really goes back to the Talmud, and that in the cemeteries in the land of Israel, and it would be interesting to see whether there was anything like this in European cemeteries, I never thought of it, that in fact there were open areas, and food was served in those open areas, and that's what the meaning here of V'akom mavrin alav barachba. Did I read that right? Barachava. 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 That maybe that's what it means. And maybe that's the origin, way, way distant.
The Sephardic Jews do bring food to the cemeteries in Israel. The Ashkenazim don't.
Is that right?
I think so. Because they have always all the chinda, you know, all the...
The what?
They have the get-together of... The
I see. Yeah. Aaron, what did you say?
The sociology has moved on a little bit, in particular with some of the Queens cemeteries, that they don't bring the food to the cemetery, but then everybody goes out to eat.
Yes.
At a nearby correct. Place. Yeah. Which, that's for a very meal, usually.
Well, Henry's, in Queens, Henry's.
And my family have the tradition of swinging what I find in Shapiro while you're waiting to line up for the cortege.
I thought.
Get a hot dog. Okay,
there always seems to be food connected in some way.
Well, here you see, I mean, Jews always say, well, there's always food connected with everything, and it's probably true. And there's truth to that. And, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing, too. But what might be interesting here is that there really is textual backing. There is a textual source for this, at least to some extent, there's a textual source.
I think if not, I'll speculate even more bizarrely. But I think it was to introduce young children to not being fearful of the cemetery. I think that the whole issue of going to the cemetery as an experience, I think that whoever began it was trying to create an expectation that this was part of the natural part of life. It was also a social event. You met people, and that the cemetery was a place where you would go. And not a place that you would never go to except on the occasion of, mm-hmm. of having to bury someone. And I think still to this day, in our family, we have traditions of the children going to the cemetery to invite the deceased relatives to major life cycle events and a variety of other things, so that there isn't this fear and awe of the cemetery as a place that's, you know, correct. Forbidden except at the one time of burial.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. This problem, this issue comes up, I wish it came up more, but modern people tend to fear the cemetery, and they tend to actively keep their children away from it. When asked the question, we are told always to say, let your children decide whether they want to go. If children are very upset by it, then it is probably not a wise thing to do. But in truth, if these things are common experience in a family, as you point out, if you visit the cemetery on any regular basis, realize that the Jewish family is supposed to visit the cemetery at least yearly, to visit during the month of Elul, before the High Holy Days. That's the tradition, is to go at that time to the cemetery. And as you say, there are other times when it is also appropriate to go to the cemetery, particularly in terms of life cycle events. It's a wonderful thing to teach children that that's an appropriate thing for them to do, to to commune with their deceased relatives, those who particularly if they have memory, or even if they don't have memory, it doesn't make any difference, really. It's their past. There's a very profound side to that.
That leads to belief in spirits.
No, well, yeah, first of all, wait a minute. I'm not sure that the spiritual reality of the dead is what we mean by a belief in spirits. I'm not at all sure that Judaism is opposed to a belief in the spiritual reality of the dead. To the contrary, we do believe in that. We believe in the afterlife. Where the soul is located, I don't know. But that it is possible to commune with the dead, that's a major Jewish tradition. Major Jewish tradition. Jews go from all over the world. They go to the graves of tzaddikim. And you go to the grave of the tzaddikim, and you go and you pray there. You ask for your personal needs. That's a very rooted Jewish tradition.
Rabbi Lamb says that you're forbidden to pray, if I remember what I read correctly, it's forbidden to pray to the dead.
Depends on what you mean. I don't know what he means.
Avoid visiting the cemetery too often.
Yeah, too often I would agree. Yeah. But that we do not have a tradition of talking to the dead, I don't see that that's true. We have a very rooted tradition of talking to the dead. Yes.
The Kennedys, President Kennedy's funeral, you know, someone whose kids did not go to the parents' funeral died early. There were consequences after that, which they had to work out. So someone said that the Kennedys were well advised when they took the kids to their father's funeral.
I think, in my opinion, that the meal at the end of the funeral is very much part of Jewish life. Whenever there's a gathering, except for Yom Kippur or a few fast days, whenever Jews get together, there's always a meal. And that's a normal life cycle event. The other thing is that this is mishigas about the children being damaged going to the cemetery. I think that's a very, very modern type of thing. But when I was a child, there was no question about, a fear. You go, you pay respect. But I don't think I was, intimidated by going to the cemetery. And I think that this is just a very modern misconception.
It is. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There's a big difference between going for the funeral, going for the burial,
right,
and going to visit the cemetery. I think it's frightening to them to see their parents who they have never seen.
It's also true.
Weeping and members of the family. It's
very
different experience.
It's part of the experience of life, and I think that
my kids always came to the.
Let's go on.
Rabbi, on the Elul visit, you ever heard of people eating then?
No.
So I guess I'm not clear about why on the unveiling that the tradition exists. And
all I know is what I said to you. Yeah. I have no great insight into this. I've told you a sociological reason.
So that's a sociological reason.
Yeah. You have more people, larger crowd. Yeah. Flul is only you.
It's also more rural. It's closer to the moment of death,
okay.
So I think that might contribute to it.
Let's go on.
Can I ask?
No questions. We must go on. There's a lot that we can cover tonight. There's an interesting material here, and I want to make some progress. Now, what the Gemara said to us is that this is extending the idea that one rends beyond these limited relatives. So in a way, this is a contradiction of the Mishnah. Now, it's gotten around it by saying, well, the Chacham, everybody relates to a Chacham kikarovav, as if it were. The reality is, we really have a contradiction here. So the Gemara answers, lo tzricha d'lav Chachamu. The Mishnah comes, therefore, to teach us about the limited situation, or the more common situation, where the deceased is not a Chacham. It simply is telling us the common situation. It is true that the Chacham is in a special case, but if you're not a Chacham, if the person who has died is not a Chacham, then it's limited. Okay? So that was the way the Gemara asked this. But the Gemara is not entirely satisfied. The Iadam Kasher, who? What if the deceased was not a Chacham, but was Adam Kasher, was an righteous, upright person? And that doesn't necessarily mean righteous, because they probably would say tzaddik. Adam Kasher means okay person. A decent person, exactly. Okay? Chayuvi mechayvin lemikra. One has to rend for that person. Suddenly it looks like you have to rend for all kinds of people now. That's what the Gemara is saying. And it brings it about Baraita. Ditanya mitnei mabanavu benotav shel adam etim kashahem ketanim. This is a weird Baraita. Why does a person's children die when they are small? Okay? Kedei sheyivkeh v'yitaber al adam kasher. So that a person will become sensitive in order to mourn over an adam kasher, an upright person. Now, it'll explain what this means. Yivke v'yit abel, so that he will weep and mourn. What do you mean that he'll weep and mourn? Children die for reasons like that? Erbona ka shakilmene? Do they take a pledge from him? In other words, you have to do something in advance in order to be able to be protected from something. Rather, he is punished with the death of his children because he did not weep and mourn over an upright person. Here's the key thing. Everybody who weeps for an Adam Kasher, that person has his sins forgiven. Bishvil kavod shel asalo. Because if you do pay respect and honor to somebody else, then you get points for it, as it were. Okay? Those points put you in good stead. Behind this baraita is the notion that children die for their parents' sins. Now, this is not a particularly modern notion. I doubt that this is a notion that you would subscribe to. But that's what the Baraita says. And the way one is protected from that, because parents feel, you know, a terrible loss, if God forbid their children should die. So the Baraita's way of dealing with it is that it is punishment for the parents' sins. Remember the Baraita, this is one of a Baraita that has a general worldview that all death is because of sin. It's not specific to this case. All death is because of sin. We all die because we sin. Okay? It's not a modern idea, but this is an idea in the Baraita. And the way, therefore, that you would be protected is by the doing of good deeds. The doing of good deeds especially that go beyond the level of normal requirements. Such as rending the garment for an Adam Kasher. Right? Doing something in response, in recognition of the honor of an upright person. Okay? So we're still left with the problem here. Okay? So now the Gemara comes and says, it's going to do the same thing it did the last time. Now it says, the Lav Adam Kasherhu. The Mishnah must be referring to a more limited situation where the people who are the people that you have to do this for are not necessarily kasherim. We don't do it for everybody, you just do it for certain people. Of course you do it for your immediate relatives regardless of what the level of their righteousness is. And by the way, there's something to that. That's an interesting thing, because one of the results of this conversation, not a lot that you can get out of that conversation, but one of the things I think one should take away from it is that one is required to do these things for one's immediate relative, even if your relative is none of the Adam Kasher. Okay? It happens. It actually happens.
It's not my family.
He's not an Adam Kasher. Not an upright person. Not an upright person. Okay? It doesn't matter. Because you have this level of relation, you are obliged to respond in a certain way. Okay? Okay, go on a little bit further. Idekai hatam bishat yetziat neshama. However, if one was standing there during the time of the departure of the soul, chayuvim mechayve, you are required to make the rend. The Tanya, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar omer, haomed alamet. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, he who stands by someone who dies, bishat yetziat neshama, when the soul departs, chayav likroa, is obligated to rend the garments. Lema ze dome, what is this like? The Sefer Torah shenisraf. It's like a Sefer Torah that was burned. Shechayav likroa. If God forbid you should be in a position to see a burned Sefer Torah, you're required to rend your garment as well. How much more so than if you see the soul depart? This is not the halacha. It's interesting. It is interesting that this, all of this development, in fact, none of this is the halacha. None of this is the halacha, with one exception, which I'll mention to you in a moment. But the halacha appears from this to be that if you are present for anybody's death, you would rend the garment. That is not our practice. And the reason why that's not our practice is that, so we say, that that would serve as a discouragement from bringing comfort to the sick. Namely, when you went to the bedside of someone who is ill, you could be afraid that you would have to end up rending a garment. People don't like to rend their garments unless they have to. So therefore, that would be... Yeah, but rending a garment is destroying a garment. Here you are, you go to the hospital, you're wearing a suit, somebody, God forbid, dies, you have to tear your suit.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Okay. So the bottom line of that would be to discourage people from attending to the sick. Okay? So since we do not want to discourage that, this has gone out of our practice. This has gone out of our practice. Okay?
How much the only
thing that remains in our practice is that in certain circumstances, when in certain communities where leaders die, you will see some of these practices occur. You will see a rending of garments. I don't know, not necessarily Hasidic, no. And the only times I've ever seen them are not in Hasidic communities, as a matter of fact. Communities that you would call Hasidic, but they're not. That is to say, they look like Hasidim to the eye, but they're not. They happen to be Misnagdim. They happen to be 100% anti-Hasidic. But they all look alike. But in a very from the yeshiva world, I've seen this done. Because of the devotion to leadership. It's true in the non-Hasidic world as it is true in the Hasidic world.
There's people who
Yeah, you will see in a synagogue like that, I would expect you would see that. In many such synagogues, you would see that. Right. Well, that would be appropriate. One is supposed to do that in any funeral. But, yes?
Translated this to American culture, American society, is if a leader dies, a sage, do the Jews mourn or render garment?
No. This, because the force of the rending here is in fact the burning of the Torah. That's really the metaphor that's behind it. It is the Torah itself that has suffered.
Yes, and
it's a loss of the presence of God in the world, which is in the sage. The sage is the embodiment of the presence of the Torah. And that is the source of the public mourning for the sage.
Is this an example where it was a biblical law, but then it didn't get incorporated into the halakhic law?
This was a Talmudic law.
A Talmudic law,
which probably was, I don't know when it went out of practice. It may not have been all that long ago.
And how does it
may have been only 200 years ago, or less than that, I don't know. I know it's not the law today for the reason that I gave you.
That if you're present when someone dies, you don't have to rend.
Correct. Although there are communities which would say if you are in the family, you do have to rend. Mm-hmm. Because then that would not be a problem because the family is going to have to rend anyway.
Right.
So the family, if you are present, you rend at that time. Generally, that is not our custom. That is generally not our custom, but you will hear it being done from time to time. Okay? Let's go on. Nope. I'm going to go on. We're not talking about all the Jews in the world. So we must go on. Mm-hmm. Okay? Next. We are going to now enter a variety, a rather long discussion of the death of a variety of rabbis. And it's just interesting to see this kind of literature. I've been pushing this. I want us to get into this. It goes on, and it goes on quite a while. There is a really continuous discussion right down to the bottom of this page. And I want us to see this. Kinach nafshei de Rav Safra. When Rav Safra died, the note there is worthwhile. It says nach nafshei. The way you say to die in Aramaic is nach nafshei. It's a nice phrase. The soul rested. The soul rested. Lo kar'u rabbanan alei. Now this is what's interesting. We just read that when a sage died in the time of the Talmud, you would rend the garment. Now it says, Lo karu rabbanan alei. The rabbis did not rend the garment for him. Right? This is the Talmud. Talmud immediately brings a case which is contrary to what we've just learned. Okay? Amre lo gamrina mine. They say, we haven't learned from him. Right? Now, this may seem weird, but the example that you just gave of Rabbi Lamb, I assume the people who rent the garment were people who had studied and studied closely with him. And that, in fact, is the case here. So one of the distinctions that we're getting here is maybe what we mean is not just anybody, but those people who were particularly affected by the Torah of the sage. And in truth, it's not necessarily everybody in all reality. But maybe it is. Amalo Abaye. Abaye says, Mi Tanya Harav Shemet. Does the Praita say the teacher, the rabbi, namely the master, such that it would be a master, your master? Rather, it says, Chacham Shemet Tanya. It says, the sage. In other words, it's not the relationship, your relationship, but it's the presence of the Torah in the sage. Right? That's what Abaye is emphasizing. V'od kol yoma shmatate befumin bevei midrasha. And beyond that, every day the teachings of a sage are in the academy. They are in the Bet Midrash. So in other words, the sage is alive. Just because this is not your principal teacher doesn't mean that you have not been profoundly affected by the sage. So here Abaye is arguing that everybody should have rent, even if they were not that close to Rav Safra. Savur ma dahava hava. The rabbis then were apparently chastised by this, and they felt that they had done wrong. But, Savur, they then reconsidered, and they said, well, what was. We didn't do it when we should have been doing it. So we were wrong. We should have done it then, but it's not the same as doing it now. Amalah Abaye. Abaye comes back in again, and he says to them, Tanina, we have learned in the Baraita, Chacham, as far as a sage is concerned, calls man sha'oskin behesped chayavim likroa. As long as they are engaged in eulogizing the sage, one is still obliged to rend for them. This too is an interesting little baraita here, because there are customs in the community about when to rend the garment. Our custom is we rend most places that I've seen, most communities in America, rend the garment. Since we have a funeral service, usually in a chapel, not always, usually but not always, we will rend the garment before the beginning of that service. However, implied in what Abaya is quoting in the Baraita now is the idea that you rend together with the eulogy. Together with the eulogy. If you look in the Rabbi Weiss's book, Avner Weiss's book on mourning, he recommends that the family not rend the garment until after the eulogy has been delivered. That's what he recommends. I've never seen that done, but apparently he's rabbi in California, Los Angeles, Orthodox rabbi in Los Angeles, and that's what he recommends. So in other words, you deliver the eulogy, the family stands up and rends the garment after that. And it's a very dramatic thing to do. It's quite dramatic.
Hollywood.
It's the Hollywood rabbi. So that... There are these other possibilities, even though we don't necessarily do it that way. It's also a question, there are some who do it at the cemetery. Sometimes you will see this done at the cemetery. You will see it done at different times. Sometimes before the casket is put down, sometimes after the casket is put down.
Sometimes there are cemetery services.
Then it's relevant. But then it depends on whether you do it before the casket is lowered or after. I usually do it before lowering the casket. We rend and then we put the casket down. But you'll see it also the opposite. All of that has to do now with the subject of the hesped. Because in Abaya's comment there is a connection between rending and the eulogy, the hesped. That is the source of these variety of customs.
I think it has to do with the issue of spontaneity. And it's going to be an obligation, but I think there's something added if it really is a spontaneous act, and maybe by connecting it to the eulogy, people are more likely to be moved to do the spontaneous act.
It's fine. It's all part of the drama in a way. You're right. Well, look at what it goes on. Savur, they then, the students who didn't initially rend, Savur lemikra le'alter, they then thought that as soon as he clarified this for them, that they would rend. So they finally give in entirely, and they know that they've done wrong, and they should rend then and there. Amar lahu Abaya, Abaya said to them, Chacham kvodo behespedo. For a sage, his honor is the hesped, the eulogy itself. So in other words, don't rend now. Wait for the eulogy and then rend. So it wasn't, the meaning of the baraita wasn't just that you can rend all during the period of time afterwards when eulogies may be delivered. And that could even be throughout the Shiva, it's possible. Because people will give eulogies in one way or another throughout Shiva. Some people who have come from a distance may talk about the deceased. We will frequently do it in Or Zarua when we study the Mishnah. We will frequently have the opportunity to learn something about the deceased. So it could mean that it goes all the way through that, but specifically what Abaya means is not just that whole period of time, but in fact in direct connection with the recitation of a eulogy. That should be the time and the place for the rending of the garment, for the chacham.
Rabbi Weiss.
Correct. That is what he is. That's what he's recommending.
So, what makes a eulogy a eulogy, as opposed to you sitting around during shiva talking about the person?
Mm-hmm. The actual eulogy involves both kvod amet, that you pay honor to the deceased, and bechi, and you. Cause the people to weep. Mm. Cause the people to weep. Weeping, there's a time for weeping. Mm. And that is the time to weep. It's considered to be an appropriate thing to weep from a eulogy.
But then, too, if you're just having casual conversation and you make someone cry, does that make your conversation?
No, I don't think so. No. As far as this goes, no. I don't think so. It's a more formal type of presentation of some kind. Yes?
You made the remark that a topic that I'm interested in is when does the soul leave the person? And you said, you know, that if I understood correctly, the death occurred and you should rend before the soul leaves the dead. I mean, what is this time? What is this this consideration?
It's a whole subject unto itself.
I know.
I don't want to approach it.
Okay.
Because right? it's not a Talmudic subject, too. It's a Kabbalistic subject.
You can
subject.
Go home and change clothes.
Okay. Okay, let's go on. Kinach nafshei de Rav Huna. Now we have another rabbi who died. Rav Huna. Rav Huna dies. Follow this. It's a very interesting story. Savur la'otove sefer Torah apurye. The rabbis thought that they would place a Sefer Torah on his bier, on his coffin, right? This as a sign of respect for Rav Huna. Rav Huna was one of the great Babylonian rabbis. Okay, Milta Dechayev Lo Svirali. Well, then let's see, I think that it says later on what the reason to... Well, I'll just tell you what the reason is. I think it comes up later on. The reason for putting the Sefer Torah on is a sign of respect to the deceased rabbi, which is to say he kept what was in this, or he is what is in this. So it's paying additional respect to him. The Gemara goes on and says, Amalahu Rav Chista says to the rabbis who intended to put the Sefer Torah on the bier, Milta de Vechaye Los Virale Hashta Lekum Leifadle, something that he wouldn't have done in his lifetime, should we get up and now do it in his death? And he explains what he means. The Amar Rav Tachlifa. Rav Tachlifa said, Ana Chazitel Rav Huna, I saw Rav Huna, debay lemeitav apurye, that he wanted to sit down upon his bed. Or, I don't know that apurye means bed there, it could mean again mita, on the couch. This is one word that means couch, bed, and beer. B-I-E-R. The hava manach sefer Torah alei. But a sefer Torah was lying on that couch, or on that bed. The chafkada aara, and he then turned a jug over on the ground. Must mean a large pitcher. The otiv sefer Torah ilave, and he put the sefer Torah on it. Alma kasavara sur leshev al gabe mitash sefer Torah munach ale. Therefore, you can see that according to Rav Huna, it was prohibited to sit or to lie on something where a Sefer Torah also was.
But what's he putting a Sefer Torah on the bed for?
I'll tell you, good reason. First of all, realize by what's described here, the picture of the Sefer Torah. And those of you who have been in Or Zaruah, particularly in the Minyan, or... So you can see it on Shabbat too, before the High Holy Days, will understand this. He takes the Sefer Torah and he puts it on a jug. Now, obviously it's a big jug of some kind, so you turn it over, it means a basin of some kind. Puts it on that. How could you put a Sefer Torah on a basin?
It's a
hole. No, the way you do it is, obviously he's talking about a Sephardi Sefer Torah. The Sephardi Sefer Torah is not like our Sefer Torah. An Ashkenazi Sefer Torah is structured with two wood spools that the Torah is wound up on. And then that is just placed in a cloth. A Sephardi Torah is completely different. Sfardi Torah is read not lying down but vertically. It's in a solid housing that simply has a hinge on the back and it opens up. So this, to my mind, is one of the proofs that in Babylonia they must have had Sefer Torah the way the Sephardim have them, and not the way we have them.
Okay? And they have two spools, though, in that housing?
Yes. Well, yes, more or less. There are spools going up like they're dowels. And it's very interesting to see how they handle it, too. I was in the Sephardi shul a few weeks ago in Jerusalem, and I don't know these customs very well, to say the least. I hardly know them at all. I often find it very awkward because you're sure you're going to do the wrong thing, and at least speaking for myself, I usually do the wrong thing. So it makes you a little bit crazy. One of the things I was interested to see was how they moved from column to column. Realize what we do to move from column to column. You hold the Etz Chaim, the wooden projection, and you turn it like this. Theirs is not structured like that. Theirs instead really has a dowel here and a dowel there, and it's simply wound up. It's wound up. There's nothing to turn. Nothing to turn. So what they did, I've seen this, and I was always wondering what the purpose or purposes of this thing were. And on a Sfardi Sefer Torah, and you can notice it, maybe you'll come this year in Elul and you'll see it in Ozarua. We have it here because we have the Sfardim, the Bavli service, the Sfardim from Iraq have the service in our sanctuary in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So they bring in, last year they had two Sefer Torah. So on those Sefer Torah is a piece of cloth. It's sometimes a large, very beautiful handkerchief, silk kerchief. Frequently you'll see a very beautiful silk kerchief. And I have seen that used when you read the Torah, or if you have a blessing, somebody will take the kerchief, touch the spot, and kiss the kerchief, like this, if you're at Mincha, you're not wearing a talit. So I've seen it used at that. What I saw done just a few weeks ago is this kerchief, they took the kerchief, and they had to move column to column, put it on the parchment itself, and therefore their hands weren't touching the Sefer Torah, the kerchief was touching the Sefer Torah. And they then grabbed it, and they moved it like this. They moved it to the next column. Okay? So you have the variety of customs then, but remember also the continuity of tradition of the Sephardi communities is with Babylonia. We're reading the Babylonian Talmud, and Rav Huna was a Babylonian Amora. Okay, so I think that you can see the antiquity of the Sephardi custom that goes back to what was done in Babylonia. Okay?
It's interesting because the Huna name in Israel now is Ashkenazi name. The first Israeli ambassador to South Africa was Huna.
Huna?
And yeah, that was his name.
Really?
It's an Ashkenazi. He was Ashkenazi. So it's interesting that it's all Sephardic, but then it converted somehow.
and the Ashkenazi traces back to the Jerusalem Talmud?
Correct. Yeah, and Ashkenazim, the Ashkenazi tradition traces itself back to the land of Israel. The Sephardi tradition traces itself to the Babylonian Jewish community. Okay? So, and that's because of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, the Romans set up a major port in Caesarea, in Caesarea in Israel, and a boat would come into there. Where would they go from there? They go to Rome. So the major trade route was between the land of Israel and Rome. Okay? That's why the Roman Jewish community has some of the oldest Jewish traditions that we have that date from the time of the Temple. Because they go back to the Jewish traders who went from the land of Israel to Rome. Then they went up the Italian boot, crossed the Alps, and populated Germany.
Cologne.
Yeah, the biggest Jewish cemetery is in Trier. non-functioning, his interior.
So your Ashkenazi European community comes through the Italian boot from the land of Israel, as opposed to the Babylonian community, which spread out through North Africa, because that was the Muslim world. Okay? So I think you can see this line of continuity even right here in this this Baraita about Rav Huna. That's not a Baraita, it's an Amoraic teaching of Rav Huna.
What would be the basis, though, for having two different formats for the Torah?
Who knows? It's just, I couldn't tell you. I don't know that anybody would ever know the answer to that. Some people might speculate, but I don't know that you could ever know. Why? After all the background I gave, all the history, the anthropology, I got to know it all? All right. What can you do? Okay. Okay, so now we see that, oh, by the way, this we learned another halakha from this, which was halakha that was actually relevant 2 days ago. This is relevant 2 days ago. I'll tell you the halakha that comes from this. Notice the Rav Huna did not want to sit on a seat where a Sefer Torah was. The practical halakha that comes from that is that you shouldn't sit on a seat where there are tefillin. And the practical ramification of that is on Rosh Chodesh. It's on Rosh Chodesh. It was 2 days ago. That was the practical ramification. Most people, in most places, will take off the tefillin, simply leave them on the seat, and then stand up or sit down on the seat after that. I don't believe that that should be the practice. I believe that one should put the tefillin away. If one is going to take off tefillin, which is the Ashkenazi custom, so take off tefillin before the beginning of the Musaf Amidah, one should put them away because of exactly what we're reading here, that it is not proper respect to sit next to a Sefer Torah. And why? Tefillin have the same status as the
Sefer Torah. Why isn't the result that you don't put tefillin or the Sefer Torah on the bed? Why shouldn't that be the thing that you don't do? Why don't you just, what are we doing putting those things on those places?
Well, tefillin, it's natural.
Because they're small and you need a place
correct,
to put it.
Correct. And the truth is, in many synagogues also, you know, we don't do it here, but a lot of synagogues have a variety of ways to hold Sefer Torah.
Right.
And they have a second Sefer Torah, for example. A lot of synagogues don't even hold it. They have some kind of mechanical arrangement. And they just leave the Torah there. I never wanted that for Azarua, because I feel that a Sefer Torah should have a human being. A human being, you can never leave a Sefer Torah. It's not nice for the Sefer Torah. The Sefer Torah should always be next to a person. Right? So that's why I never wanted to do that here. But there are places you'll see where that's common practice. There are a lot of places. Correct. One of the things you do in building a shul is to build a way that the Sefer Torah is just held by itself. Okay? It's very common in American synagogues.
So, Carlin, did you say why the Torah was on the bed? Was that just because he was studying it?
Well, no, we don't know why. It could have been it was just placed there. Well, there's no evidence to why it was done. Okay? But the bottom line of this is, whereas the rabbis thought that it would be a way of showing respect for the rabbi on his deathbed, on his deathbed after he had died, during his lifetime he wouldn't do that because it wasn't proper for the Sefer Torah. Alachat kama v'chama, how much more so would it be inappropriate of all people, Rav Huna, who we have a story about, we see that he thought it was improper. Okay.
I think it's also you don't share a bed with a Torah.
If that's what it means is a bed.
What?
If what it means is a bed.
It defies us.
If what it means is a bed. Okay. So he did that. Alma kasavar al gabe mita shesefet Torah munach asur leishev. It's forbidden to sit on a bed that has a Torah scroll resting on it. Okay. Now the maras goes on. Lo hava nafik purya mibava. His bier, however, could not pass through the doorway of the house. It was too wide.
This is a New York problem.
Okay. Interesting thing to describe. So it couldn't, they couldn't get it out. Savua l'shalshule dere gagin. So they had a way to do it. They figured they could shimmy it down from the roof. Okay? You could put ropes on it and then take it down from the roof. Apparently there was access to the roof from wherever they were, but they couldn't get it to the door to take it down the normal route. Amalaho Rav Chista says to them, Hagamir Nemine, I learned from Rav Huna himself, Chacham Kvodo Derech Petach, part of the honor of a Chacham is that he always walks through a door. Now what that means is a lot of things. A lot of things, and you can think about different contexts where this is true. If you're in any position of leadership, you have to think about certain things like coming in and going out, not in a way that would be inappropriate to your position. In fact, you don't want to climb down the side of a building. It's just, you know, it's not appropriate to your kavod. And in your kavod, your honor is not you, but your honor is beyond you. You're really standing for something else. So there are many situations where you might, because you're in a monkey, would want to express itself, but your outer... Took you a while to get that. But your outer sense of appropriateness is just not appropriate to do.
Are you talking from personal experience?
Oh, I never. Okay. So, Chacham Kvodo Derech Petach. The appropriate thing for a Chacham, he's got to go out the door. So what do they do? He couldn't fit through the door. Savur la'ashnuye mipurya lapurya. So they figure he had a good idea. We'll take him off one beer and we'll put him on another beer. We'll put him on a narrower one. Okay? Amar laho Rav Chista says to them, Hachi gamir neminei. I also learned this from Rav Huna. Chacham kvodo b'mita rishona. A Chacham, you can't move him from beer to beer. It's not nice. You put a person in a coffin, and then you keep moving them from coffin to coffin. It's not nice. This is no way to treat the deceased.
Deduction.
Right? You put them one place, you deal with it. Oh, wait. There's always a solution to a problem. Okay. De'amar Rav Yehuda amar Rav. Because Rav Yehuda said, the Rav said, Minayin l'chacham shekvodo b'mita rishona. How do we learn that a chacham, a sage, his honor involves that he should be in the first bier and not in additional ones. Vayirkavu et arona Elohim et agala chadasha. They placed the Ark of God upon a new wagon. That is to say, the Ark itself, when they were bringing the Ark to Jerusalem, after it had left the Philistines, right, they put it on a new wagon. How many wagons? A wagon. One wagon. Okay. So what did they do? Parus bava va'apkuha. They did the only thing you could do. They broke down the door. They broke down the door. And they then took him through the door. There was a way to solve the problem. And it was in line with the honor of this particular deceased. It was more important to pay respect and to honor the deceased than to keep the integrity of the door in its place.
Is the beer a coffin?
I don't know. Because I honestly don't know. And there's no way that I know that we can know. I just don't know.
But ultimately, the person is going to be taken off the beer into the coffin. Well,
I don't know. I can't say that. Because remember, the problem here is that the Israelis today do not bury in coffins.
That's right. But so they don't bury them in a beer either. They're just...
Correct. So that's why I don't know what a beer means.
So you should be able to carry the person out the door.
So maybe it means the...
A litter.
Right. Maybe it means a litter that they would carry the person on and then just lower the person either as is or wrapped in... what do you use? Mats. Cane mats. The problem is that we don't know what this means because we have no evidence.
But if
these things just don't waste.
If
they don't last.
It would be archaeological. evidence of Moses, this Egyptian carpet.
But if it's wood,
the land of Israel, we have to bury them in the ground. And that's in the land of Israel. I don't know that there's.
They had all kinds of different kinds of burials. I think there would be evidence of that. There are from other cultures.
I don't know. The other cultures are different from the land of Israel.
Bet Sharim, you were, but that's before that time.
Right? No, Bet Sharim is the time of the rabbis. These are the.
So they just put it for a certain amount of time in the.
Well, what we do know, we know about these caves, and we know about these ossuaries, because
they took it out.
Not because we found the bones. But because the ossuaries were made of stone.
And you didn't take the ossuaries to the home.
Correct. The ossuaries were kept. There was apparently a procedure where you would bury first, you would let the decay take place, then you would take the bones and put them in the ossuaries. You know, we know that from literary sources, but we have the ossuaries. So we have evidence of this. We have, as far as I know, I don't know any evidence of the meaning of the word nita. If any of you come upon it, I'd love to know.
In Israel, if you die, the Chevra Kaddisha can put a stretcher.
Yes.
That's what he says, right? It's a stretcher.
That's what they do now.
Yeah. And how do they bury you? I mean, where do they bury you?
They
just wrap the stretcher and put you into the grave.
Tachrichim means shrouds. Shrouds, but particularly they lower you down, don't they, on a machatzemet?
No, they take the same stretcher and they slide it down. And somebody's inside, help it pull it down.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
So your body is
down, and then they put the cement blocks on it.
Cement blocks.
You know, it has like, because it's open, so it's not like a cover. And then you put the dirt.
What is the cement blocks on top of?
So you don't throw the dirt on the body direct.
What are they?
You don't?
Yeah.
No, you don't.
Oh, really? After all that?
What you do, they put they dig in, they put like perimeters of cement blocks.
Perimeters around, not on top of the body.
And then they put the body within this perimeter.
Yes.
And they put few cement blocks on the top of it, which is, it doesn't need to be completely closed. It's just to cover, and then you put the dirt on that cement block.
It's like a
in some places you don't do it at all. I mean, it's just convenience. Right. So.
Yes. Very interesting. Okay, we will continue next week.
Thank you. Rabbi, can I ask you a question about when that halacha changed?
Hold on, just 1 second. Let me just mark where we are.
It's been so long since you and I walked home together.
I know. Your schedule has been alternate.
That's when we are.
Said that was no longer part, one of those rules was no longer part of
it. Shuki said to turn off the lights, but he was coming back. He was going out to eat, and then he was coming back, but he made the lights off.